Welcome to Building 72, the podcast brought to you by the Entertainment Arts and Engineering Program at the University of Utah. Thank you for joining your hosts, Adam Hunter and Corinne Lewis, to talk about the video game industry and, you know, probably other stuff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Building 72. I'm so excited today. I'm Corinne Lewis, and I'm your host, and I'm here with my excellent partner in crime, Adam Hunter.
Hi, everybody. Yes, Corinne is very right to be excited because we have an absolutely fantastic guest with us today. Her name is Rachel Leiker, and I will just let her introduce herself because she'll do a much better job than I ever possibly could.
Hello, everyone. My name is Rachel Leiker. I am the lead creative designer at Hardsuit Labs, currently working on Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2. And I graduated from the EAE program in 2015 as part of Cohort 4, or C4, because when in doubt, C4.
I always like the C4 reference when we talked about it as explosions. Although yes. C4 didn't really have a lot of explosions, so
we were explosive in terms of success.
That's very true.
Oh,
I agree. I 100% agree. So Rachel was on the same team as one of our previous podcast guests, Kyle Chittenden.
Yep.
And so it's fun to get to talk to all. This is part of the reason why we're doing this is I miss everybody so much.
Fair enough,
everybody. Rachel and I are actually friends and have been friends for way before EAE started.
Way before.
I owe my love, my deep abiding love of jalapeno chips. Yes. Rachel, this is how we bonded back, I don't know, in 2005 or something.
Gosh, yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
College of Humanities.
Yep. We both worked for the College of Humanities at the University of Utah. And then when I started EAE with Roger and Bob and Mark and Craig, very quickly we realized we were going to grow. And I talked Rachel into coming over.
It took very little convincing.
Common thread, Corinne convincing people to come join EAE. Not that I know anything about that at all.
Well, I just like to work with people I really like, so that's helpful.
So that actually, that's because obviously Corinne and you have a much bigger history than you and I do. And you had mentioned before we were recording that you were involved in marketing back in the early 2000s. How did you end up in the program and interested in video games as a career?
Oh boy, that's a good tale. So my background is in graphic design and sort of web development, front end, user experience, all that good stuff. So I started out doing a lot of sort of marketing and departmental development as far as fundraising and stuff like that. So a lot of heavy on the graphic design elements. So posters, booklets, audio visual stuff, presentations, all kinds of things like that. So I was able to kind of develop the visual skills. And then when user experience started to become an actual discipline in, the late aughts, if that's a term I can use. super dating myself right now. This is great. So when that started to become a discipline, I started really diving into what is user experience. It was kind of an offshoot of human computer interaction, or HCI, thinkings and philosophies that had started as early as, you know, the 60s. And it basically comes down to how people interact with both the technology component, but also the emotional component of the things that they are doing with computers and with websites and with, you know, the appliances they use and stuff like that. So it's the philosophy in a nutshell is essentially like, how can we make this the use of this very cold mechanical thing feel better? And so that kind of translated for me into how do we engage audiences with, fundraising initiatives in a much more emotional way, as opposed to us just being like, money, please. And sort of how to also engage students in what at the time was perceived as kind of a do nothing discipline, which was, you know, the humanities. So like, what are you going to do with a college with an English major? Go, you know, make coffee and give people fries? Like, it's not a thing, right? Like, and we had a lot to work against at the time because STEM was coming up and all that garbage, but, well, it's not garbage, but you know what I mean. Anyway, so I started developing the skills and user experience to start talking about the humanities in a way that was applicable for both our donors and our students to understand the value. Fast forward a few years, I had kind of topped myself out in that particular sphere and was looking for new challenges. I'd always loved video games, always played video games, was really into kind of the philosophy of video games before I knew what it actually was and the design aspects of video games. So when EAE started spinning up and I was talking to Corinne about what this program was and how I could help develop and grow the program, it started to kind of look like a viable career choice for me because there was a lot of similarities between what I was doing for marketing and what I could be doing for video games, you know, leading people into an emotional experience as opposed to just a purely functional experience, giving feedback in ways that is meaningful for our viewers, things like that. So then I kind of started shifting my perspective toward user experience for video games. And that included things like UI, included things like level design, included things like narrative, things like that. So about a year into me actually working for the program, Corinne then again convinced me to be a student, and rightfully so. So I was able to kind of translate what I was doing for the program professionally into also participating as a student, and graduated, got a job in games, and here I am.
Well, what that story, which is, I know that story, but what there's a part, another part of that story that I love, that I adore, is that your parents wouldn't let you play video games. So you used to go sneak out to your, you know, your friends and play. So they tried to prevent you.
It's true. My parents hate this story because they're like, no, we didn't. And I'm like, but yeah, like when I was younger, I like begged my parents for a Nintendo. Like, you know, it was just the coolest thing. Mario was awesome. Wouldn't do it because it would rot my brain, you know, same reason I wasn't allowed to watch a TV after six. So my neighbor had one. So I would sneak over to her house and be like, well, I'm going to go play with Jenny. Bye. And then we just sit for hours and play Duck Hunt and Mario and Zelda and all the classics. And then my other neighbor, Michelle, had a Sega Genesis. Mm-hmm. So then I could play like Jurassic Park and Sonic and Mortal Kombat. But don't tell my parents that. so then it was just kind of like this clandestine thing that I did forever. And then they bought my sister a PlayStation and I was like, okay, fine. You know,
so unfair.
thankfully she was very generous and we played a lot of multiplayer games together and couch co-op and all that good stuff. So I was able to kind of like
floats all ships, right?
Exactly. And then, ever since kind of that barrier broke down, we've been a video game house ever since. So we've had like all the consoles and, my sister and I still play, both my sisters and I, play constantly, both on PC and console. You know, we're constantly talking about games. It's a very big part of our family now. And, you know, even my dad really likes, you know, the solitaire, even though he says it's not a video game. It's totally a video game.
That's funny.
I have a quick question. Cause this is, I have not a very similar, but like, you know, I also didn't have a console until I could buy one with my own money. So I'd go to my cousin's house and play. When you were younger, did you have a pipe dream of maybe I'll make video games one day? Or was that something that never crossed your mind?
Actually, it never crossed my mind. I wanted to do comic books ever since I was small, and try to develop skills toward that. And then, so video games started becoming an option for me kind of when I started delving into user experience. Otherwise I was just like, oh, it's not going to be a thing for me. Like nobody works in video games. It's really small and, you know, highly specialized. I don't know how to 3D model, you know, all this other stuff. And then suddenly here I am. So.
And do you 3D model? Can you do that?
I can model a mean cube.
Well, sometimes that's all you need.
I can texture it pretty well as long as it doesn't contain any sort of UV stuff. Sorry, Gabe.
Well, one of the coolest things you've ever done was before you came to EAE, and people have ripped it off all over the country about why you should study humanities.
Oh yeah, the T-Rex posters, yeah.
Yes.
For the College of Humanities, we did this campaign that was kind of framing science with the humanities, or instead of a STEAM discipline, it's a STEM discipline, STEAM. And the poster that Corinne is referring to is a picture of a scientist going, woo, standing next to a large egg that's cracking. And it says something to the effect of science can help you clone a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And then the next frame is a T-Rex chasing the scientist with its mouth gaping and looking like it's going to eat it. And then the caption is, humanities can tell you why this may not be a good idea. And that got picked up by Reddit a few times. And I think that they made t-shirts and
it all over.
Yeah, it was leased out by another College of Humanities in Ohio, I think. And then it got subsequently sniped, and I think there was a lawsuit, but I don't know how it turned out.
That's hilarious.
I know, right?
Well, and you also had, when you were with us, you had a history of designing a really cool t-shirt for us, and then the next year, all the GDC shirts would look exactly like ours.
I'm not saying it's a thing, but it might be a thing.
Comparisons, at least twice.
Yeah.
So hilarious.
You never know.
But now you are working on, I don't know, are we calling it double A? Is it triple A?
TBD. I don't know. Paradox is, I would consider, a AAA publisher, just because of the quality and numbers that they do. Our studio is not AAA numbers. We're only still about 100 people, which is definitely not like, you know, a Ubisoft or a BioWare size studio or something like that. But, you know, we're significantly sized and working on a fairly major franchise. So AA plus, if that's a thing, I don't know.
I mean, you know, there was a long time where I never even heard of double A, like nobody ever called it that. And I'm like, are we just talking about batteries still? Because I'm pretty sure that the baseball comparison breaks down. So if it's not the baseball, if it's triple A, I don't know. But so your first job out of school was interesting.
So the 2015 was an exciting year for me. Graduated in May, got married in September, moved to North Carolina in October, and then got a job with Boss Key Productions in December. So Boss Key Productions was a smaller studio out of Raleigh, North Carolina, working on a hero shooter called Lawbreakers. Unfortunately, it's no longer live. It's because it was all multiplayer based. We couldn't keep the servers live, but anyway, look it up on YouTube. It's actually a really cool game. So I was picked up as a contract UI artist / UX designer and got to work with some of the most amazing people that I still talk to almost every week. It was a really, really, really good first time experience for someone fresh out of school, I guess, because, you know, got to meet really, really cool people, got to work with some industry vets, which was awesome. Got to work in like a really cool, like loft type place in downtown Raleigh and, you know, all the cool stuff that happened around that. And then, you know, launched my first like major title in, when did that launch? That was 2016, I believe. And then so after that, my partner and I moved to Seattle because he got a new job. And I kind of stayed on working remotely for Boss Key, just finishing things up until we went gold. And then I started working at Hardsuit Labs. Working remotely was, and now that we're all working remotely, this is kind of weird, but I decided to pursue the job at Hardsuit because I was kind of tired of working remotely and just like by myself in a room all day. Again, hilarious to say now.
No jokes on you.
I know, right? I have experience in this. Anyway. So I really wanted to be in like a studio environment again and working with really cool people like face to face. And Hardsuit was kind of the size I was looking for. And when I first interviewed at Hardsuit, I had no idea that they were working on Bloodlines 2. I thought they were, you know, still maintaining and working on DLC for their previous game, Blacklight Retribution. And I was like, I could go work on another shooter. Why not? And, you know, when they told me what they were working on, like officially, I make a super weird noise. I kind of like fangirled out. for a minute. And I was like, oh God, they're not going to hire me. Cause they're like, I can't hire this person.
I remember that day. You're like, I made a noise and it's not happening.
Yeah. It was awkward. But they kind of took that as enthusiasm for both the IP and the project and hired me. So yay. since then, so they hired me as a UI UX designer. About a year later, I became lead UI UX designer. And then as of, gosh, like this week last year, I was promoted to the lead creative designer based on some different needs that the studio had at the time.
So let's talk about that for a little bit, because mm-hmm. I know certain terms mean different, like a technical artist at one studio might be very different than a technical artist at another studio. Creative designers, that's not a term that gets tossed around very often.
Correct.
And it could mean different things. So what would you say you do here? what is the life of a lead creative designer like?
Yeah, so this is kind of a specialized, well, it's not really specialized, but it was a position that was created almost entirely custom for me based on some needs that the departments and sort of the senior leadership team needed. My job is basically an intermediary between the creative director and departmental leads so that there can be a little bit better direction and communication flow between those two particular streams. Because we're still relatively small, there's few people at the top and bandwidth is very, very limited. So the more, you know, communication flows that are going upward, you know, stuff tends to get lost. And then also communication downward can also be misinterpreted and then it's hard to follow up and all the good stuff. So, when we were kind of going through a bit of a postmortem process and developing kind of how we wanted to proceed with the game, this came up a lot. And it was basically just like, it's hard to get a hold of the creative director. Creative director says, like, it's hard for me to articulate to the teams what my vision is, all that good stuff. So we determined that it would be good to have kind of these intermediary positions on both the kind of content side, which is my position, and also on the gameplay side, which is a kind of lead game designer position over on the systems and engineering side. My compatriot position, I guess. And this was just to help kind of fill that communication gap and also help provide more direction, more concrete direction to the department leads and the departments themselves. So for me, I oversee, I don't oversee. That's a heavy term and I don't like using it. Anyway, I help manage and provide direction for level design, narrative design, and UI UX design. So those are my kind of three departments. I also oversee a kind of ad hoc user research contingent along with our QA lead and some other QA people. And this is just kind of a coordination of playtests and divvying out the user research into their whoever requested it and or whoever needs it, things like that. But so my day-to-day is pretty much kind of look at the progress of our goals for a particular milestone, see if there's anything that's being blocked, if anybody has any problems, if there are any questions as to the overall direction or needs at that particular moment in time. I also check in with all my leads to see how the people are doing. This has been absolutely critical over the last year. There's been just kind of a greater need to, you know, make sure that people are feeling okay. Yeah. And that they, you know, are mentally all right,
yeah.
I guess, yeah. You know, because, you know, we were all very close when we worked in the studio and we all, you know, got along really well. And there was always some kind of lunchtime activity going on, or we'd all go to the pub that was right by the studio after hours to, you know, just let loose or whatever. And we can't do that in the COVID era. So, you know, the mental health spike has been very real. So a lot of my time over the last year has actually been in sort of the peopling realm, just, you know, making sure that we're hitting problems before they escalate, making sure people feel supported, providing resources, and also conversely, like how can we have a cohesive team remotely? You know, what does that look like? Do we do more activities remotely? Do we, you know, is that annoying to have virtual happy hours every week? You know, stuff like that. Like we're all kind of discovering this together and you know, trying to find the best solutions. But yeah, so then on the flip side of that, I take, after checking in with all the departments and making sure that they're all okay and removing any problems, then I then can go talk to the creative director and say, here are the things we're experiencing. Do I need them to go to bat for us on something? Do they have an opinion on whatever? Scheduling reviews, all that good stuff. And then just making sure that everyone is sort of aligned as far as the work moving forward.
It sounds like you are in a million billion meetings.
Yes, I am.
So thank you for having another one with us.
Yeah, no problem.
Well, and I find it fascinating when you were talking about, because that falls kind of right in lockstep with the stuff you were talking about earlier about like the human connection and everything. But now you're just kind of working on, at least to a degree, you're working on the user experience of the studio itself and the users yep. being the employees there.
Yeah, yeah, it's a twofold thing. I'm doing a user experience of like the studio experience. And then one thing I like about this position is I get to have kind of a broader experiential touch across multiple disciplines. So before, and in a lot of studios, UI UX is kind of confined to, you know, user interface and menus, but user experience can be expanded outward to almost every aspect of the game. For example, like in user experience for level design is incredibly important. We just did a major pass on the game on sort of landmarks where, you know, we want the player to be able to step outside and then automatically say, oh, that looks like an interesting area, which is a user experience problem.
Yeah.
And so from there, we were able to say, okay, what do we want the player to see? What's the hierarchy? What's the most important thing we want them to see when they walk out of a door? How do we tell the player interesting stuff happens here and what kind of interesting stuff they can expect? And these are all, you know, these are all really fun design problems that are multidisciplinary and take a lot of coordination between like level design and lighting and environment art and UI and all kinds of stuff. So that's been really fun for me recently, is those kinds of design problems and coordinating the people to help solve them. And that's been really cool.
That does sound like fun.
Yeah.
Do you get to do a lot of, like a lot of leads, once they get up into the lead position, they're doing a lot more of the lead stuff and the producerial stuff and the wrangling and the organization. Do you still have time to actually do like the design stuff and to be able to contribute to that stuff? Or are you more kind of making sure everybody else can do that?
I'd say about 3/4 of my job is enabling people to do the stuff and then just providing a direction to go. Is like, go north. And when you head north, do these things, you know? I don't care how you get there, just go. And then about 1/4 of my job is actually being able to like do design.
That very seems cool. Like a good combination, because yeah. you're still keeping your hands in the, you know, the dirt and yeah. growing things.
Yeah. It's really nice.
Metaphor.
I mean, and I've known people who don't prefer that at all, right? Like I've known people yeah. who've been in the industry for 30 years and they're still like lower level designers because they're like, no, I don't like yeah. wrangling. I don't like organization. I just like levels. So just give me all
that's
the levels.
Totally that's totally fine. Yeah, that's, we have a few people like that as well. And it's like, that's great. I will yeah, remove awesome. Every single roadblock for you so that you can just do your best work. Because that's what I enjoy doing. So yeah, I work with like some really insanely talented people. So I'm actually just really happy to be like, here is an idea, go do something cool. And then they do it and it's great. So yeah.
Well, there's such a feeling of being able to like trust your teammates to
so
actually
nice.
Be able to do that, right?
Yep.
Like it's so, I don't know if satisfying is the word, but it's so good to just be able to be like, I can release this to these people and know that what comes back will be good and quality yep. and what we're expecting.
Yeah, it's a good feeling.
I think it matters that people have this, have, I mean, we all have layers of goals, right? But we have personal goals, but when we all have the same goal as a team, it, and everybody really understands that that's the goal. It's funny because I'm working on syllabus construction right now for this semester. And I'm thinking about that because we're talking about projects classes. And so that's really on my mind right now. So that's cool. I highly also recommend being able to hire people that you like to work with.
Yes. Yes. I super agree with that. Knowing that you like to work with and also that you trust. So
trust is important. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Cause I've definitely worked with people that I thought were hilarious to work with, but I didn't have the same goal as them.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I was just thinking about you moving from North Carolina to Seattle. And do you feel like, have you noticed any differences in how you I guess where I'm going is North Carolina is a very different culture than Seattle.
Very.
But do you feel like games is kind of a more evening the playing field kind of culture?
I do, actually. We see this kind of broadly. My partner used to work in Montreal, which, you know, seems like a scary thing since it's a different language and it's a different country and stuff like that. But even the people that I've met that, you know, he worked with there, we all speak the same language, you know, and we all have the same values, and we all kind of we're all working toward the same goal, essentially, which is to like make really cool stuff that people enjoy. Mm-hmm. So there's a community there that is completely independent of, you know, your location. There are, of course, like, you know, larger communities like in LA and Seattle and Austin, as opposed to like really small ones like in Raleigh. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all still share a bunch of commonalities that make it just really easy to connect. So, yeah.
I wonder, I mean, I don't think we've ever talked about that before, because Paradox is a Swedish company, right?
It is.
So yep. They probably have a very different, aesthetic isn't the right word, but they probably just approach things in a little bit different way than us Americans, you know?
A little bit. Yeah. They're actually really fun to communicate with because, of how, this is going to sound weird, how European they are. Mm-hmm. like one of the first meetings I had with one of our executive producers, he's from Germany, but had been working for Paradox, in Sweden for years and years and years. And it was for a specific piece of feedback that this was very early in the project, by the way, this wasn't recent, but that they had disagreed with, and everyone had warned, I was in this meeting to help explain kind of the direction and where we were taking it, to give them more confidence. And everyone was like, okay, it's gonna sound like they're yelling at you. Please don't take it personally. And I was like, okay.
Okay.
And this had been after, like, I had had a colleague like scream at somebody in one of my previous positions for, you know, not getting an animation done on time. So I'm just like, okay, so I'm gonna get yelled at. That's whatever. It's fine. And then so that this executive producer like came in and was just like, well, I wish we had better news, but this is a little disappointing, and we kind of just want to know the direction that you're heading. And I was like, oh yeah, totally. Here's the direction, blah, blah, blah. And everyone afterward was like, are you okay? I'm like, it's like the most civil piece of feedback I'd ever received in my entire life. It was crazy that people were just like, oh my God, are you going to be all right? So a lot of their communication it's very direct, which I think a lot of Americans don't necessarily know how to deal with. But it's polite, and it's all relevant. You know, they're not doing it to be mean. They're just doing it because they think it's true. And then we have a discussion and we come to a resolution and the end. And it's great. I, for one, particularly enjoy that style of communication, because kind of the way that we tend to talk about, especially kind of here in Seattle, there tends to be a little bit of a dancing around the actual feedback, that can lead to misunderstanding and misalignment. So when we're communicating directly with our publishers over at Paradox, they tend to be very direct, and it's just kind of refreshing because you always know where you stand. So,
well, have you ever thought that any of that was due to being a woman in the game industry? I guess I feel like I should ask that, but I don't feel like that. So, but I'm not directly in the industry. So
I'll back up this statement by saying that the meetings I am in, I am not the only woman in, mm-hmm. but we are, of course, a minority because games. But the communication that I have experienced is, you know, it goes across both sides, rather than just simply directed at me. In this particular context, I don't believe it is because I am a woman and people feel like they need to be gentle with me or whatever. Because I can dish it out just as well as
I was going to say, they don't know you very well.
They do now. But yeah, I personally haven't experienced that in my communications with Paradox. You know, being a woman in games is you experience all kinds of things, but in that particular context, I, you know, I haven't ever received that kind of intention from them.
That's good.
This is probably going to sound like a loaded question, but like, is well, and this is an honest question because I'm obviously not a woman in the game industry. Is the industry getting better about inclusion and about smashing perceptions and stigmas and things like that, or are there still hurdles that need to be overcome?
It's a process. I think we are better now than we were, you know, even a year ago. 2020 was very eye-opening for many different reasons. Like for us at Hardsuit, we now have a very major diversity and inclusion and belonging initiative that's spinning up right now. And it's very central to what we want the studio to be moving forward into the future. And we're making strides to, you know, be really intentional and formal about it so that it doesn't just kind of, you know, float away. So that's been really cool for me and a lot of people at the studio to see, and gives us a lot of confidence in both our studio leadership and also kind of the longevity of the studio as a whole. As far as the industry goes, yes, I think that things are getting better. I do think there is still a lot of work that has to be done for, you know, all kinds of minority groups getting into games and experiencing what it's like to be in games and game development and all that good stuff. There's a wealth of information, you know, out there right now, but it just needs to be internalized in a way that is productive, you know.
You know, I remember when I first started teaching, I would say to students, and, you know, we're in Salt Lake City, Utah, so yep. Whatever that means. And I would say, you know, the more diverse game makers we can have, the better, because mm-hmm. we want to have, because people think about things differently. We want new and interesting games. And I would have pushback from that always. I would say that has radically changed in the last even 3 years.
That's good to hear. That's really good to hear.
And I definitely, we're seeing many, many more, not just women, but a much more diverse group of people coming into the program. So
that's great.
It's great. I think
I'm very happy.
I want them to design crazy games I've never thought of before.
Oh, I know. Right.
Right.
Yeah. Like the spectrum of perspective is so important to making cool stuff, you know, like if we're just making the same thing over and over, it's really boring.
Right. Right. I mean, I love platformers, but you know, I mean, I will always play a platformer probably, but still we've had all kinds of crazy things. It's great. So cool. I love that. I'm glad to hear that too.
Yeah, me too.
I'm glad to hear that too, because I mean, obviously, again, given kind of my status and everything like that, not status, but given my position in the game industry, I'll always hear horror stories, or I'll hear things and I'll obviously try my best to try and internalize the things and learn the lessons and everything like that. But it can sometimes feel really crappy to be like, it sucks that that's going on, but it also sucks that I can't, like, I don't know firsthand the stuff that's happening, right? I've heard from friends and coworkers and everything like that, but I can't speak to it personally. And that kind of lack of being able to sympathize with it kind of sucks, because it's like, well, sorry that games can be toxic sometimes. Like it's bad, right?
Yeah. No, well, the good news is, you know, even though you haven't personally experienced it, which good for you, you can still hold others accountable when you do see it, you know, which is in many ways way more important than having that experience of it yourself. So
yeah, very, very good call.
Yeah. And I've said for years, it's like, if you try to tell me that I'm not part of your community, honey, you're not part of mine. I've been playing since Pong. So you don't get to own this tag, you know. Yeah. Gamer tag applies to me. I mean, it applied to me when you were not alive. So don't
It's true. And also the biggest demographic in gaming is still women in their 40s.
Yes.
That no one talks about. So.
I know. I talk about it because, you know, yep. I say, we're winning. Yay.
Yep.
Yeah. So, and this woman who's over 40 is really excited about playing Bloodlines too.
Thank you. I'm excited for you to play it.
No, there's actually lots of stuff coming out that I'm really excited about. So it's, I do feel like we're, I think that the pandemic working has slowed things down or changed things, but I think it's changing things. You know, we're really, we all slowed down enough to start looking again and not just rushing. And I'm ready to start rushing because I'm over it. Yeah. And I was kind of over it in July, but you know.
Yeah. Tell me about it. Yeah. One thing that we've kind of seen in the studio as part of the whole COVID thing is we have to be way more intentional about how we communicate. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's to more meetings. And some people are just like,
I'm just over that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But at the same time, we've all sort of had to relearn how we're talking to each other because it's not a quick cruise by somebody's desk anymore, or, you know, a large-ish group meeting in a conference room where we have a whiteboard and all that stuff. So we've all had to develop this kind of higher level of articulation and expedience in that articulation that I think has been really interesting, but also really beneficial. And the other thing that we've seen in a lot of positive, I'm just like, user research nerd, and because I've like studied this in our studio, how we give feedback has changed like radically. Mm-hmm. In the studio because of COVID. Before there was a little bit of tiptoeing. There was a little bit of, well, I don't want to hurt feelings. But now it's kind of that European model where we're more direct, but respectful, mm-hmm. About the feedback and solution oriented. So it's not just like, I think this sucks. It's more like, well, I don't think this is delivering because X, Y, or Z. And that's been really, really beneficial for us in this COVID era because we're not together and we can't ask follow-up questions easily. And, you know, Slack is a very poor medium for conveying emotion and intention. So
that's why emojis exist.
Oh boy, do we have emojis.
Adam is the master of Giphy.
Yes. It's a good thing. Yeah. but you know, what we're seeing is just a higher level of verbal and written communication among all of our developers, just by merit of being working from home. So that's been kind of interesting.
Well, sorry, Adam.
No, go for it.
I can see you and it looked like you were about to talk. I was just,
nope.
You go.
No, serious.
What I was going to say, I'll say it really fast and then you go, is this reminds me of when, you know, because we have the experiences like you are really good friends with people that you were going to school with every day.
Yeah.
And then the second you graduate, you never see them again.
Yeah.
And I think that unless you were very intentionally trying to remain friends with people, you just don't, you know, life rushes in and you have other things to do. And when we're working together, if you aren't intentional about getting time together, it can go sideways.
It's so true. So, so true.
Adam.
Okay. I don't like interrupting.
That is bad podcasting. No dead air.
No dead air. I'm kind of fascinated by UX as just like a thing, especially because I don't know nearly as much about it as I should. And so I probably already know the answer to this question, but I want to ask it anyway. Do you find that because you know so much about user experience and you've delved into it for a really long time, do you find that your coworkers, you're often explaining concepts to them that they've maybe never thought of before, where you're like, well, actually we need to take this into account? Or is that something that people maybe have more of a baseline understanding than maybe they give themselves credit for?
Yes and no. It depends on my audience. So I work with a lot of graduates from other game programs. Sadly, no EAE people yet, but working on it. Anyway, so they have kind of that academic background to where I can say things like flow state, and they know exactly what I mean. But I also work with a lot of industry people who don't have the academic background. So it that particular thing translates directly into kind of how do I explain what the player is doing at any given moment? And I'm saying the exact same thing, but I'm framing it differently depending on who I'm talking to. And as far as explaining concepts, I only do it if people ask me, to be honest, because like some stuff on a theoretical part of game design is really abstract for some people. And the commonality though is framing things from the player experience. When the player enters the room, they are expected to do this. Here are the verbs that they can use. What they are going to spend X amount of time doing this one thing, and then they're going to move on, blah, 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 blah. And that's just a common ground level thing that all developers understand, regardless of, you know, academic background or not.
Okay. Do you find that when you talk, you mentioned earlier, you're talking about like, okay, now we're gonna have a discussion about landmarks. Because the player needs to be able to see where they want to go or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of stuff where is stuff like that a basic idea that everyone's like, oh yeah, we probably should have that. Or is it something where some people are like, oh yeah, I never really thought of that before.
It's a little bit of column A, a little bit of column B. So for that particular initiative, we had already kind of laid the groundwork for the landmarking. Mm-hmm. It just needed to be, you know, dialed up to 11 to provide more feedback for the player. Before, it was just kind of like they were there and they were cool, but they didn't necessarily indicate to the player that cool stuff happens there, which was kind of the main impetus for us adding more on top of it to indicate cool stuff, essentially. That, and I'm always an advocate of more feedback is better than not a lot of feedback. So it was just like benefits all around, you know. So we tell the player that there's gameplay there, it looks really good, so people are going to take screenshots. You know, there's it's good for the team to, you know, come up with cool design solutions for how to make it look cooler on a budget. And yeah, it turned out to be a thing that everyone agreed was a thing, and then we all worked together to make it a goal and to kind of figure out where that target was. And that was all super beneficial and sort of happened just kind of organically out of trying to solve a problem, essentially.
Very cool. Awesome. Very cool.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we are almost out of time.
Oh no.
But we have rapid fire questions for you.
Ooh, good.
The lightning round.
Yes. The lightning rounds.
So I guess we'll establish some rules. Okay. We'll put a timer on the clock right now. First answer.
There's not really a timer.
There's not really a timer.
Okay, I was like, Zoom can do that? Whoa.
No. No, but we have Connor who can edit it in if we want.
Yay, Connor.
All right. What is your favorite game of all time and why?
Knights of the Old Republic. What? Because it was the first time I had experienced a multi-branching storyline and a way to romance multiple characters.
I thought for sure you were going to say Mass Effect.
Precursor, okay. Mass Effect, though. Same team.
This wasn't on the list, but now I have to ask, was that, because like everyone usually has their handful of games that they'll say like, this was the game that not necessarily made me want to make games, but like this was the game that opened my eyes about something. Is that one of yours?
That's probably one of my favorite games to play. The game that opened up my eyes to actual game design and game elements is Baldur's Gate Dark Alliance for the PS2. And the thing that got me was the freaking water shader in all the dungeons, and I was just like, wow. Oh my god, that's so cool. That and just the breadth of their crafting system and how, you know, the stats and all that stuff, how you could build weapons and build into gems the style that you wanted to play. And I was just like, this is so fascinating. Anyway, so that was the game that kind of got me into thinking about game design. But my favorite game from a player perspective is Knights of the Old Republic.
Very cool. What games are you playing right now?
Oh boy. I just 100%ed Assassin's Creed Valhalla because I'm a huge nerd.
I'm getting really close on Odyssey.
Oh my god. I had like 180 fault. Hours in that game too.
Oh my god. I don't even want to know how to look.
Yeah. It's okay. Don't it's fine. It's fine. Those games are, I play those games both because I enjoy them, but also from a content perspective, they're really fascinating on how they feed the player content. and the pacing of it. So I play them half for research, half because I just like them.
I agree.
yep. Can, and then you, I'm playing
can you
through.
Turn off the research aspect at all? Like, can you just enjoy sometimes. A game now?
Sometimes. I don't research. I intentionally don't do research when I play dungeon crawlers because they're my favorite genre and I just want to play them. Mm-hmm. I find them very soothing. Like one of my top games from last year was Minecraft Dungeons. It is like a perfect distillation of a dungeon crawler in just like a really good wrapper. Like, you don't have to worry about a whole lot of equipment management because it's very streamlined. It's fun. It's cute. It's got really great music. So yeah, I turn my brain off when I play dungeon crawlers. But yeah,
sorry,
otherwise
no, I derailed you on that question.
Oh no, you're totally fine. otherwise my design brain is on always, like constantly. Like, I'm always looking at feedback systems. I'm looking at how the interaction is, what the controls are. I'm looking at UI. I'm looking at I was playing a lot of I was playing a lot of Gears of War 5 last year, which is a very good game, both from just a general player experience and just the decisions that they made to improve on the Gears 4 experience, because Gears the wave of kind of things that you can do in those games kind of skips iterations, and 4 was very streamlined, and then they iterated again on top of it for 5 in really clear ways that I find really fascinating. So I spent a lot of time studying that game. Right now I'm also playing Hades because everyone's playing Hades and it's great.
Everybody's playing Hades.
Yep. And I also picked up After Party on Games Pass, and then I'll jump into Sea of Thieves every once in a while. And then I am in a couple tabletop groups, so Vampire, of course, and then Dungeons and Dragons and a Pathfinder campaign I'm starting on Saturday.
Fun.
Yeah.
Very fun.
So I play a lot of games.
So other than KOTOR and other than Baldur's Gate 2, what game from the past do you wish you could have worked on?
Ooh, that's a good question. Titanfall.
Oh.
How come?
I can see that. You love that game.
I do love that. I love both those games. There are interesting design problems to solve in both of those games. Titanfall 2 is obviously a little bit more successful than the first one, for many, many design reasons. But the problem set of the first game is something that's very interesting to me that I would have liked to help solve.
Cool.
Very, very cool. We have two more left. You're given $10 million in a couple years. What game do you make?
Only 10?
Or what type of game?
Only 10.
Okay, 50. You're giving $50 million.
Only 50?
Only 50?
With your
I'm not made out of money, guys. Come on.
Oh gosh.
In any game, you're given a studio and they say, Rachel, make us a game.
Third person action RPG. Definitely. I would really like to make a The Thing game. That's, I know there was one for Xbox movie like a million years ago, but yeah, I like the idea of having a game where you have to fight both an external problem and also an internal one that you can't see. I've been playing a lot of Phasmophobia recently as well, and that model applied to The Thing would be really, really cool. Anyway.
Very, very cool.
That is one of Jason's favorite movies, not just John Carpenter movies. My favorite John Carpenter movie is not that.
Escape from New York?
No. Big Trouble in Little China.
Oh, yes. It's an excellent movie. That would also make a great game.
In my top five.
That would make a great game. Holy cow, would that make a great game.
The graphic novels that they did with them are great.
Ooh, I need to read those.
Yes, you should. You should. You should.
And the last question we usually like to end on, what advice do you have for students who are listening to this, who are either going to be starting their career soon or are thinking about going into games, or even Rachel from 10 years ago, what advice can you give to the burgeoning game developers of the future?
I have two things that I like to tell people. One is, it's okay to be a nerd about something. Like, don't be afraid to walk into an interview at a place that makes the game that you love and tell them how much you love it. 9 times out of 10, they'll consider that a passion move, and that you are already like, you don't need a lot of training essentially on like the IP or why it's important. And those are all just bonuses. So don't be afraid to be about a nerd about something in an interview.
So don't be afraid to squeal when they tell you.
Yeah. Don't be afraid to make a weird noise when they tell you that they're making one of your favorite games, a sequel.
It worked out for you.
It did. And then the second thing is when you go to network, and everyone should network, these are your peers. They are not, you know, people on pedestals. They are not people who are above you. They just have more experience, but they are your peers. And talk to them as such. You know, we're all, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we're all part of the same community. We're all trying to make something cool that people like. And there's a lot of commonality there. So when you go to network, don't be afraid. And, you know, just talk to people like they're people.
I love that.
Yeah, that is fantastic. Wow.
I love that. Oh, Rachie, it's so great to see you. Thank you so much for coming and doing our podcast.
Anytime. That's I'm always happy to talk to you guys.
Yep. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.